Can speak, and they can speak again, of course.
Sure, yeah.
So, where I'm starting now, we are on chapter 7, Family, Youth, and Culture by Trotsky. We have studied Thermidor and the Family, which is the chapter number one, or the portion number one of chapter 7. So, I'm going to try to make a summary of what there is in this beautiful document, which is called Thermidor in the Family. So, the way it starts, according to me, I have put some notes in the chat so that might help. So Trotsky says that the revolution, 1917, had made a heroic effort to destroy the so-called family hearth, this archaic, stuffy and stagnant institution in which women of the toiling classes performs galley labor from childhood to death. Do people follow me? Is my English clear? Yeah?
Excellent. Thank you, Marie.
Better than mine.
So I carry on then. And so Trotsky says the revolution and the young government gave to women all political and legal rights in equality with man, and more important still, access to all forms of economic and cultural work. This was done with the intention of replacing the family as the shut-in petty enterprise, which is an enterprise, and to replace it with a finished system of social care. So there would be social care, accommodation, maternity houses, creches, kindergartens, schools, social dining rooms, social laundries, first aid stations, hospitals, sanatoria, athletic organization, moving picture theaters, etc. And that wasn't just for the woman, but mainly addressed to the woman condition. This would unite old and young in solidarity and mutual aid. The Soviet family before 1917 was generally a nest of medievalism, with female slavery, daily humiliation of the children, superstition, great backwardness. The changes in the bureaucratic approaches to the problem of the family, you could say, and Trotsky does, characterize most of all the nature of the society. When you look at this, you appraise society. So we off we go in the meat of the matter. There was no lack of support for the idea of creches and kindergartens. The notion of family proved not to be a very entrenched matter. The people responded quite well to it, particularly the people who were more advanced in the peasantry. They appreciated the advantages of collective care and socialization. We are now in 1935. This book is written in 1936, but Trotsky is looking back on the last few months. He says the social dining rooms were poor, but much poorer they were in the working class area, and very few in the collective farms. The peasant's wife was glad of the social dining room if there was one, and the working woman needed it. But as soon as the food card, the rationing card, was abolished in 1935, and the ruble, the currency, reintroduced as a means of distribution, the better placed workers began to return to the home dining table. It would be incorrect to regard this retreat as a condemnation of the socialist system, because that system was in general never tried. But the workers and their wives had not been impressed by the social feeding organized by the bureaucracy. And same with the social laundries. The Communist International had passed a resolution on the, quote, complete and irrevocable triumph of socialism in the Soviet Union. Apart perhaps from the better off, so that's the end of the quote, apart from the better off women who had servants, nurses and charwomen, the women of the factory districts were not impressed. All those in charge of literature and the newspapers in the Soviet government saw the return of the workers' wives to their pots and pans, and they decided that perhaps it wasn't such a bad thing. But this is a summary of the document, because in the meantime, there has been a process which is leading from the family as it was to the changes of the revolution and now back again towards the pots and pans. There is a first conclusion of Trotsky on this. He says, it proved impossible to take the old family by storm. The real resources of the state did not correspond to the plans and the intentions of the Communist Party. Society had proved too poor and little cultured for this. So here I'm jumping things because I think I'm going to go on too long. In the large rural population, the family had strong traditions in midget enterprises. Social dining started in some agricultural collectives, but few, and the peasant family generally continued to manage through its own isolated efforts. Another conclusion of Trotsky. Once the necessities of life are acquired by the isolated efforts of the family, there can no longer be any talk of social dining rooms. The midget farms created a new basis for the domestic hearthstone, with a double burden upon woman again. So we are going to look at the situation in detail. There were 600,000 creches in 1932. They were permanent creches. And there was 4 million seasonal ones in the summer, you know, to permit people to go and collect the crops. They numbered the creches almost 6 million instead of 600,000 in 1935. So there was a great growth in this in the creches, but the steady ones, the ones which were all the time, they were only a small part of this. The creche was often no better than a bad asylum for orphans, says a Soviet paper. So that was not very good. The better placed workers' families avoided the creches, and for the rest of the other families, there was never enough to go round. From 1930 to 35, the number of kindergartens rose from 370,000 to more than 1 million. But still, 1 million was very little. So the bureaucracy, the Central Executive Committee, no less than that, felt compelled to say openly that measures had to be taken to end homelessness and uncared for children in the streets, and that these measures were very weakly carried out, not well done. In 1935, the paper reported that in Moscow, 1,000 children live in extraordinary difficult family conditions, and another 1,500 are turned out into the streets. 7,500 parents were brought to court for leaving their children without supervision. So Trotsky says there must have been much more of this if this finds its news in the newspapers. Homeless children are the direct result, he says, of a great social crisis. The old family continues to dissolve, as per the revolution, but the new institutions are not able to replace it. And now about prostitution. In late 1935, Izvestia informed of the arrest in Moscow of 1,000 women selling themselves. Record shows many working women, among them called working women, clerks, university students, and others. What drives this? The need for shoes, for a dress, a need for a little more, but shortage. Those in government do not speak about this, and they do not want others to do so. The very fact a law has been enacted to punish prostitutes shows that it is a big problem, a national one, and it wants to suppress the problem. The bureaucracy wants to suppress the problem by introducing repression, pretending the problem is not there because we have suppressed it. No one says, Trotsky says, no one says that the Soviet regime should be blamed for this particular degradation of women. But it is unforgivable in the presence of prostitution to talk about the triumph of socialism. In 1935, the restoration of money relations and the abolition of this rationing card resulted in the growth of prostitution, unwanted and uncared for children, homelessness and abortions. Where the problem is hidden, Trotsky says, the woman, prostitute and the homeless child become parias. They are treated like dirt, which is another attack on women and the family. Bureaucracy revealed its inability to serve women who are punished, women who are punished for presenting at the hospital for illegal abortion injuries. Those falling into the claws of the jailer are working women, between inverted, servants, peasant wives. They are severely punished. But there was, on the other hand, our women. In the newspapers and Pravda, they talk about our women. These ones, they buy perfume and they are very nicely dressed. They manage to get their keep as they like to do, and they do it discreetly, but not even so. They sometimes do it under the noses of the indulgent judiciary. They are not taken to court for abortion or anything else. The reaction of the bureaucracy become moralistic against abortion. A man called Saltz, I didn't discover who he was, "We have need of people," he said. "So women must bear children and feel the joy of motherhood." That was against abortion. A draft law was announced by the Central Executive Committee, passed in June 1935, to forbid abortion. Proof again that was a large-scale problem. An attempt at some public discussion was soon closed, proof that there was large-scale opposition. This was a law against women, the logical fruit of a Thermidorian reaction, a shameful law. How long have I talked now, please, Ian? How long have I got left?
As long as you need, I think.
About 12 minutes, I think.
I have 12 minutes left.
No, if you just finish, because I know more or less where you are in the...
In the book, okay. You tell me, somebody.
No, you keep going.
Okay, I keep going, thank you. So instead of saying openly, we are still too poor and ignorant for the creation of socialist relations, this will be done by our children and our grandchildren. Instead of saying this, the bureaucracy forces people to comply with a new morality under the threat of extreme penalty. And in doing so, trying to glue together again the shell of the broken family, all the while pretending that this represented the nucleus of triumphant socialism. So you can see the farce that this is. With a new morality, there returns sin and punishment. So I have put in the chat about seven commandments. I think this is tongue in cheek on Trotsky's when he talks about the seven commandments. It's something to do with adultery, which is forbidden, and it's too many divorces. So there will be a law. You will have to pay money to register your divorce, and you must register because everybody knows you are divorced. A tax on divorce, heavy on the poor, evaded by the privileged layer who have apartments, working women serving them, good things, and automobiles. Where power is combined with comfort, prostitution takes the elegant form of small mutual services and can even assume the aspect of the socialist family. We saw last time how Sovnotsky had written about the importance of the automobile harem factor, automobile harem, in the degeneration of the ruling stratum. It is at the bottom of society that the costs are the most difficult to bear and the humiliation the heaviest in this repression. Treacherous and ludicrous, the arguments in defense of socialism. So women were told, we need babies, morality, the end of divorce, no abortion, no homeless children, etc. The same arguments which were advanced towards women, apparently to liberate her, to say that these things now have been eradicated, these same arguments are now used to limit and control women and, of course, the family. So you've got the resurrection of the family in this way. The state no longer discards the authority of the elders, the mother and the father. The honest leadership would have admitted that this was not socialism. There was the iron economic necessity that limited the liberation of the human relations, and just that needed to be explained, but that was well beyond the bureaucracy. The pretense of socialism goes infinitely farther than the required, than what is required by the iron economic necessity. So I say that again. There is an iron economic necessity which makes it that we cannot make socialism yet. But the pretense of socialism, that is something which was not necessary and goes infinitely farther than what was necessary. Instead of admitting that abortion, prostitution and divorce continue to exist, and therefore admitting that we have not socialism, instead of that, the ruling stratum insisted that this is socialism. And these things have now been done away with it. It's a falsification. We will see Stalin was very good at falsification and all the crew around him. Bourgeois norms have returned, like the payment of alimony. Alimony, yeah? What you pay to the partner if you keep the child. But such a return of bourgeois law, with it, you have to add the social investment, the social interest of the ruling stratum in deepening this bourgeois law. So you have a bourgeois law which comes back, and then there's the social interest of the ruling stratum which makes it even more bourgeois. They make a cult of the family, therefore a cult of all this, without any shame. The bureaucracy needs a stable hierarchy. It needs a stable society and relations in society by means, and it does it by supporting itself on 40 million points of support for its authority and power. So this 40 million is the 40 million families. So later on, we will discuss that again. 40 million families. That means quite a big population. During the 1927-32 period, which is the few years of the first five-year plan, children at school would denounce father and mother for drunkenness or religiousness to re-educate them. So it goes to show to you that from the revolution to 1932, there was still an intervention of the children and of to transform the family and denounce the father for drinking. Though, what was the good of doing this in the school, said Trotsky, question mark. This shook parental authority to its foundation. And now we are in 1935, a sharp return is being made back towards the family. Honor your father and mother. This is the fifth commandment. But in this case, there was no reference to God, at least not yet, says Trotsky. So in this going backwards, there was no telling if God would not come back. The October legislation had taken a bold step in the direction of a family freed of daily vexation and regimentation. In the future, says Trotsky, the very idea of laws about abortion and divorce will sound as backward as houses of prostitution or human sacrifice. In the USSR of 1935, the Thermidorian legislation is beating a retreat back to the bourgeois models. The bourgeois models. What produced this retreat is economic and cultural backwardness. In the main, this was the origin of this retreat. But there was no need to cover this retreat with false speeches about the sacredness of the new family. Socialism had not been built, full stop. The covering up with hypocritical respectability is denial of reality and proof that the ruling layer had interests other than those of society, that they want the power to lie and with impunity and to justify themselves with impunity. You get two types of reaction, says Trotsky towards the end. Those furious, you've got people who are furious at the criminal measures taken against the homeless children. So you've got that type of person. And then you've got those who stop at the broadness and magnanimity, you know, the fine ideas and ideals in the Soviet law. This is all very inspiring. These two types of people look forward to the time when further growth of material wealth will gradually fill socialist laws with flesh and blood. So Trotsky is not going to accept that. It is not difficult, of course, to admire the beauty of the socialist ideas. But it is impossible not to be indignant at the optimism of those who leave this task, making socialism. The optimism of those who leave the task of making socialism respectfully in the hands of the bureaucracy. And, you know, we had seen this web people of the Fabians who had visited, they came from Britain and had visited. And when they came back from the Soviet Union, they went to, they reported and they said it was such a model society that they had seen. As if, says Trotsky, as if the equality of rights between women and men were not already converted into an equality of deprivation of rights by that same bureaucracy, as if it were written in some book that the Soviet bureaucracy will not in the future continue to introduce oppression and to put new oppression in place of liberty. Socialism is worthy of the name, when it's worthy of the name, that's the conclusion of Trotsky, means human relations without greed and friendship without envy or intrigue and love without base calculations. Past experience demands an implacable distrust of all privileged and uncontrolled guardians. You cannot abolish the family. You have to replace it. That's it. I jumped all sorts of things. I applaud myself, Soviet style.
I think two of the comrades want to speak first, yes?
Uh-huh.
Who's speaking next?
Yeah, presenting as well, Suzanne and Diana.
Okay, I had some comments to make because when I first read this, I'd sort of thought this really is quite harsh. So I did some research on Trotsky and some of his other comments, because this isn't specifically about just the women's things. But anyway, he did point out that the legal status of women in the revolution, their civil, social, political rights were much superior to the rights of most women in most of Europe's countries, especially the capitalist democracies. So they had the right to vote, the right to run for office. They could divorce. They could have an abortion. They could have their own papers in their own name. They could earn a wage without permission from their husband or father. And the revolution decriminalized things like homosexuality. And it had a massive program to teach literacy. Trotsky believed that only with the growing incorporation, however, of women into all aspects of social life and not just industrial production could an accelerated fight be waged against centuries of backwardness and obscurantism. Now, obviously, there was a lot of pushback because of the, you know, as was seen, the complaint about the atheistic, shall we say, model, or the, I suppose it'd be fairer to say it was the secular model. But literacy in particular had been used by the Orthodox Church to, it basically didn't teach literacy to be a form of freedom, and it was restricted to those, and it massively meant that about 90% of women, and certainly only about 60 or so percent of men, could read. And it was very much a case of, it allowed the serfs, if you like, the lowest of the working classes, to be deprived of their chances to improve their lives, because they were only taught, if you like, what was in the Bible or what was considered for them. Trotsky shared the maxim of Charles Fourier, who's quoted by Engels as saying, in any given society, the degree of a woman's emancipation is the natural measure of general emancipation. And he quoted that. It's obvious that there is, until there is actual equality of husband and wife in the family, in a normal sense, as well as the conditions of life, he's talking about work and so on, we cannot speak seriously of their equality in social work or politics. And that, I think, is the identification. Now, that's his problems of everyday life. And there's another quote: for an indefinitely long time and constant internal struggle, all social relations undergo transformations. Society keeps on changing its skin, and each stage of transformation stems directly from the preceding. Now, this process necessarily retains a political character, and it develops through collisions between groups in society. Outbreaks of civil war and foreign wars alternate with periods of peaceful reform, and revolutions in the economy, techniques and science, the family, morals and everyday life develop in a reciprocal action and do not allow society to achieve equilibrium. Now, that's his introduction to the first, the permanent revolution of 1930. Now, I found that he has a lot more interesting things to say. I was very impressed by the fact that when he was formulating his ideas and writing pamphlets and so on, he evidently used what I suppose, for want of a better word, you'd say was a questionnaire, where he actually consulted other people about what should be, what other people wanted and how it could be instituted, rather than just simply fixing things. And he rightly bemoaned the fact that during the 1930s, particularly things like the abortion rights had shocked many aspects of the family, for the simple reason that if women acquired more education, which was particularly the literacy, and therefore chose not to have families or to work, then the people who saw them as cannon fodder, you know, and fodder for the factories complained. And that's why, if you like, the restrictions come in about abortion. We're back to the old feminist complaint. So to sum it up, I'd said basically the women's problem is men, and it won't be solved until we solve the problem of the way that men and women interact in the home, in their social lives, as well as in the workplace and public life. And Trotsky is basically saying that in the 1930s, and that, if you like, is the perpetual problem of society, East or West, and it's a matter of time as to whether or not that becomes. I don't think that just the revolution will change it. As he says in that final piece, it's about changing slowly with time, with circumstance, and gradually improving. But we are not improving if men and women are not more equal in all aspects of their lives. And that's what the revolution set out. And I think the complaints about the failure are the fact you can't just legislate for it. It has to be a genuine transformation of the relationship between men and women in society. And that's what he was trying to portray. But I could be wrong. So yeah. By all means, criticize me if I haven't got it. Have you got any comments, Diane?
Sure. Diane is starting to speak now, yes?
Yep. Yes, if you would, please.
Yeah, okay. No, I hadn't done any more research than just read the piece that we were given. But it's certainly true that the position of women in society as a whole can't improve unless the relationship between men and women improves in the whole.
Mm. One of
the things that struck me when I was reading Trotsky's comments on abortion, he rightly makes the point that, as happens here, in fact, that, you know, happens here now and has done throughout my life and before, that if a woman gets pregnant, she'll have an abortion for economic reasons because, you know, she can't support another child. That will usually be if she's on her own, but not exclusively. That will also be if she's in a stable male-female pair-based relationship. That can still apply. The family can't support more children. But what he doesn't mention, which doesn't get mentioned enough now here, is that pregnancy and childbirth is a very real physical and health risk to a woman. Just by getting pregnant, a woman is in physical danger. Clearly not that massively, otherwise the human population wouldn't be as prolific as it is, but that risk is always there. The other thing, just the mere fact of pregnancy and needing to give intensive nursing and care to a very young baby puts a woman in a weaker position. I don't know how many women, when they go through their full 9 months pregnancy, then have to go through childbirth, actually feel very bright and bouncy all through that time and can do as much of everything else. Well, Susan will be able to comment on that. I can't because of my lack of experience. But so just a kind of what looks like, on the face of it, a kind of equality, isn't going to be total equality unless you take account of the biological position of women, or the biological position of women who don't remain childless, or don't or who don't manage to avoid pregnancy. I think I made a American, oh yeah, I think that's probably all I've got to say just now.
Thank you. Yeah. And I do think that you've put the finger on it in the sense that it is that failure of the revolution, if you like, to, I wouldn't say industrialize motherhood and childbirth, but when it was about food, as Maria talked about, when it was about food, what were they? In effect, rationing cards. When there was no financial, monetary thing in it, then children quite rightly reported parents for getting drunk and not spending their money on the child. But they at least had the food, the childcare, the kindergartens, the provision of care. But where it's clearly going wrong is when society does not take responsibility for ensuring the care of the child, which is an economic burden, nor the fact that if you have divorced because you've married a bad husband who's a bad father, or vice versa, there is no proper provision to take care of that child, hence the orphans on the street that he is complaining about. Yeah.
Okay, I'll just open it up for discussion in a minute. I just want to welcome Nigel to the meeting, who's not been to one of these meetings
Hello,
before. Nigel knows us for one. He's been sort of in a we've talked to him before anyway, as a comrade earlier on in the history of our group, but I haven't seen him for quite a while actually. So welcome to Nigel. And I think Paul wants to speak next. Is that right?
yep, you had your
Yeah,
hand up, Paul.
just a minor point. Well done to the three of you. He may not have acknowledged the dangers about pregnancy. However, in the chapter, he did actually mention this is the barrelty when abortion will be introduced, or forced rather, when it was made illegal. He did make reference to the disparity between what was faced by the working class woman and what was faced by the upper echelons of the regime, and the fact that what do you call it, I suppose the text referred to it as a maternity house, but in terms of midwifery, there was still a long way to go, because he did mention in the chapter about the number of women, in his words, that were mutilated by the effects of having abortion. So yes, he may not acknowledge the pregnancy, but he did acknowledge the kind of things that were happening for those that were in the unfortunate situation of, in many cases, effectively forced to have abortion because of poverty and whatnot or other. And there was this disparity of the affected women, depending on the often their class, but also the geographical element, because apparently I can't remember the word, but in the mountain parts of Russia, many of the women that were reported mutilated by the effects of abortion were not. The true numbers were not recorded, and that sort of thing. So I don't entirely buy the argument that Trotsky didn't understand the dangers of pregnancy. I don't agree with that. That's what I, that, yeah, I just wanted to make that point. That was a, well done anyway.
I think there, though, you're The point is, women died in childbirth. They didn't always die from abortion. The problem really was that they ended up in hospitals because they were no longer capable of having children. But again, it's a moot point. I was quite surprised by how Trotsky was quite so condemnatory of women who were prostituting themselves because they wanted perfume or they wanted better clothing, or like men who wanted to drive cars and things. And there is a certain element of a lack of sympathy, shall we say, for women who may not have had the education that would have got them a better job, but therefore ending up, or just simply ending up on the streets because they were not able to access the jobs and employment. Yeah. But it's difficult to tell where how from the language of the time whether that is as big a criticism of them or it is a criticism of the society which isn't giving them the employment opportunities that they clearly needed.
So Ian wants to speak.
Yep.
And I really like Marie's point about social development. And also, Susan made the same point, really, in a slightly different way about social development, how you can't actually solve problems to do with oppression, women's oppression, the oppression of children, whatever, it can't be just abolished by decree, by a revolution. It has to be materially overcome through social development and through, well, through social development and also material development, really, because I think that the biggest problem that Trotsky points to is the impoverishment of the society, and the regression was really the function of that, and the acceptance of that isolation that was part of the program of the bureaucracy. And I think that's the underlying thing that he's pointing to. I do actually agree that there's a slightly moralistic tone in some of Trotsky's comments on some things in that essay, but I think that's the sign of the times, to be honest. I think Lenin was a little bit moralistic about some things as well. I could quote remarks from Lenin that are probably a bit worse, probably worse than that. But I think the point he makes is that there are different types of prostitution. There is prostitution that is really, really degrading, and it's basically people being forced to sell themselves to eat in a very, very, in a very, very straightforward and crude way, and I think that really is a social evil. I think he's right to talk about it in those terms. I don't think he's I think his emphasis, it does sound moralistic, though. It does sound condemnatory in both cases, actually, but I think it really is all a question of social and economic development. If you don't have the opportunity to do certain things, you will do other things. You have no choices, and it's about changing the choices available to women, to children, and to people, to the population as a whole. And I think the narrowness of Soviet development, that was actually, it wasn't simply a matter of material backwardness. It was also about a program of isolationism and of trying to solve all that within one framework. It necessarily led to regression, I mean, there are people around today, even in Russia, who there's been bans on abortion or restrictions on abortion. Abortion was re-legalized by the Stalinist regime after Stalin's death. It was re-legalized by Khrushchev, and a much more liberal regime has come along. Was the norm for quite a long time until the collapse of Stalinism, and even afterwards. What's going on in Russia now is a regression again, but this time it has a nationalist element to it as well, which I think it did then. I mean, there are people like Dugin who point out that there's huge areas of Russia that are underpopulated, right, where there's very little population and large areas of land that's a tempting target for invasion or, imperialist occupation. His solution is to force people to have babies to move there. I mean, that's a reactionary solution, isn't it? To banning abortion or restricting it, and the Putin regime has done some things along those lines, And in some ways, it's addressing the same problems in a slightly different way. It's certainly not, they have even less in common with the revolution than Stalin did. At least he pays some lip service to it, but these people don't at all, but really, we have, we're talking about how we how these, these forms of oppression can be overcome in the context of a revolutionary, revolutionary project. I think Trotsky is, Trotsky is right in putting it in that context. That I think Marie actually laid it out very well, and Susan, in terms of social development, the way to overcome oppression is through social development and giving people choices, and if those choices don't exist, people do what they have to, what they see they have to, what they think they have to. So, oh. And I think Diana wants to speak there.
Yeah, so just about Trotsky's comments on prostitution. He listed the types of women who were to be at, performing as prostitutes. They weren't unemployed women. They were women who were working. They were doing clerical work. Or students. One of the things he said they want is shoes. To us that might sound indulgent, oh, we want a nice extra pair of shoes, but there was a lack of shoes, so perhaps they actually wanted shoes because they needed them. And the impression I got from what he was saying, although whether he was being sympathetic or not, I don't think he was, but the impression I got was that the women were operating as prostitutes because they needed more money than they could get with their jobs or or as students. And women do that now, not all women who operate as prostitutes now in our society are ne necessarily totally unemployed in any other way. They quite often do it to feed their families or to fund themselves through college. And I got the impression that that was the kind of thing going on that Trotsky, where Trotsky was describing it.
Sure. Paul.
Yeah, Ian, I just wanted to pick on a point that you were making about Russia today with regard to large areas that have lots of land but not much population. And you talk of family being forced to have children. But we had, in this country, we had similar schemes in the past. That was the real story behind child benefit. Or it wasn't called that when it was in originally introduced. But the point was, after the two world wars, there was actually government incentive, wasn't there, to try and get more people to have children. So I guess my question is, when you say people forced to have children, what form are we actually talking about? Are we, are we talking of incentive in the way that they attempted in Britain many years ago? Or are you talking about something more sinister?
I just come back on that. I mean, I was just talking about banning abortion. That's all I was talking about, really. I think banning abortion does tend to force people to have children,
Yes. I mean, I think it's twofold because in the 50s and 60s, the government offered an incentive, if you like, by paying second and more children benefit. You didn't get a benefit for the first child, but you got it for the second and third and so on. So if you had a bigger family, you got more benefit. Whereas the Tories notoriously are now only paying benefit for the first two children and only for the woman. So you could go around fathering a child by lots of women. You might have to avoid trying to pay alimony, you know, child support, but the woman is only allowed to have two children. So she's rationed, which of course came up with, you know, well, what about if you have triplets? What about if you have IVF and you have, you know, four children, because that's how it happens. The government doesn't care. It doesn't care if you are raped. If you are raped, you do not get child benefit unless you know the name of the child. And the form to fill in for if you have been raped and have a child is about, I think, 27 pages long when I last looked. It's a ludicrous piece of, you know, vile legislation that, you know, we're still back to the days of, if you suffer a sexual assault, women will end up with the baby, men will end up with the trauma of being assaulted, but they won't have a child as a permanent on their future economic activity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I know, she's vile, isn't she, Diane?
Yeah, who needs misogynists with a feminist like Harriet Harman?
Oh yeah,
I don't think she's a. Anyway, sorry, Marie.
Marie wants to speak.
Oh yeah, don't be sorry. I think it's a good discussion. What strikes me is when he talks about automobiles and the women with perfume. There's something stinking, nevertheless. I think what Trotsky does, he's not condemning the people who are doing it. He says that, you know, look at the inequality in society, which there was. Even though I imagine he says it could not have been entirely avoided, it's nevertheless very galling to see that a woman will be jailed for abortion, but the woman of the bureaucracy over there who has a job somewhere and who has a father-in-law or mother-in-law or sister somewhere in the Communist Party, that one will be able to even do these things in front of everybody and will not be troubled. And all that will be presented as a socialist family, you know, this privileged living. And in those days, having an automobile or a telephone to phone the shops to actually order your food for your kitchen, that was high. I think it was high privilege, really, when you think people would prostitute themselves for a pair of shoes. So I don't think Trotsky is condemning those who are the prostitute or the automobile. It's just the way it is used by a layer of society, which has still to this day not been analyzed. I mean, you look around and the communist parties have not matured this. They have not matured Stalin. And they do not, and they tend to defend Russia yesterday and Russia today, just from a sort of prejudice almost, leaving to the bureaucracy the task of bringing socialism in the future. I think one has to be very careful that I think Ian touched on it. The present Russian leadership is even more backward than this by a long chalk. And so Yeah, it's full of conclusions on how, why, how to be careful not to defend Russia in, for example, in the Ukraine United Front that we have, not to defend Russia unconditionally without and finding Russia always in the right because it's Russia. There, one has to be careful that this is the position of the communist parties, but it is not correct. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, one thing I did look up was I'm not going to pronounce it properly, Lisbet. It's the reading program that was instituted under the Tsars. I think it's only the Slavic language that was taught to read. By the time the revolution had sort of period of, had gone through, so that's up to 1925, they were teaching. And the literacy had not only risen, but they were printing books in 25 languages. And I believe now it's more than 104 languages. They have been dedicated to both, shall we say, equality. And I would defend the fact that I think Russia is a far more equal party than. A country, it recognizes far more languages, it recognizes more ethnic states, and it seems to be more comfortable with itself and the various peoples, but I could be wrong. But what they do is recognize the importance of those and the experience of certainly black people in the 19, you know, from the 20, you know, from the 20s through to the, well, even to the present day, we are looking at people from African heritage, whether it's American or from the African and South American nation themselves, who insist that there is far less racism in Russia than there is in, you know, either the West, Europe, or other, than America. And I'm looking at the exhibition of black icons of Jesus and the Virgin and the whole people. This is a church who's comfortable with itself looking at a black Jesus, not a white one. It's looking at a dark-haired, dark-eyed Jesus and the whole family within Christianity as Palestinian, not as European, which is what the Christianity became, you know, from the Vatican, if you like, from the 15th century onwards. And I think that reality is something that we do not recognize how much it is not faced. Yes, we don't look at our own inequality. We don't look at our own tolerance for it. We don't look at the fact that as a society, we are not. We're not trying to provide everybody with a car, but we're not trying to provide them with public transport either when they don't have a car. No, you know, and it's the same for women. We're not trying to provide everybody with a creche. We're not doing the, but we don't provide them with equality of pay so that they could pay for their own childcare. Yeah. They at least are trying. Sorry, Diane.
Diana, yes, you want to speak.
Yeah, the thing about abortion and incentives to have children or not have children. I would say that a good society, a well-functioning society, is one that that operates for its people and its children. But what we seem to have that was with the USS in the 1930s and always currently and previously, before, or throughout this century and before, is that that the birth of children being treated like either spare unnecessary burdensome objects or useful objects for the society, the economy, and the power. So to me, that's totally upside down. And from a health point of view, abortion has to be freely available to everyone. And if there's and for a proper functioning society, there has to be support for all children who are born. I'm a great believer in the woman's choice. It's a woman's choice whether she has an abortion. It's a woman's choice whether she wants to go through with pregnancy and childbirth. A man can't make that choice. A man's body doesn't allow it. But at the same time, any resulting children are a part of the society, belong to the society, and the society belongs to them. So it should be a sort of mutual supporting thing, and a proper functioning society would make sure that it operated like that. And that would be where things like creches, childcare, and all the rest of it comes in, and how that's arranged. That is another issue. The practicalities of it, how that's organised, but it one way or another, a proper functioning society organises it.
Yeah.
Susan.
Yes, I noticed when you did your first set of notes, Marie, you talked about hearth and home, and that is the sort of way that Trotsky comes into this first part of the pamphlet or the book, in fact. And I think what his audience would have understood by that and would have been much more aware of is this whole, the whole, the hearth. Vesta, Hestia. It goes back to, Roman Empire and Greek. The whole point about women as being the guardians of the home, men as being the people who went out as soldiers. Yes, that the society was much more hierarchical, and that there was a domestic sphere that women were supposedly in charge of, although. As patriarchal religions got more and more oppressive, it tended to be every man in his castle, even if his only slave was a wife. It's the whole business of that recognition of hearth and home that is important in understanding that he's trying to unite, home domestic relationships between men and women. And therefore, the revolution, when it first starts out saying we're going to give equal rights to women, that means divorce and abortion, which were notably not available to women in European societies in America. Now we're looking back at a society where abortion is not going to be available to American women. And if they had their way, all these wretched NGOs and American, evangelicals are going to come over here and make it not available to us either. This is a serious interference where certain rights, because they are being taken away from a group of people, a particular gender, they are not regarded as human rights. And I think the really important thing about the Russian Revolution in particular was that it stamped equality between the sexes as the most important thing within the society. And this particular chapter is about the ways in which society can constitute itself so that the genders have, as far as possible, equal rights between them. And he puts that firmly at the center of the revolution. Don't know what anyone else thinks about that.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yes, that's true. Yeah, I think the regression in Western society is becoming quite obvious, isn't it? You know, particularly in the United States. I mean, the United States right wing are trying to export this stuff to Europe. Whether they will have a lot of success is not very clear at the moment, but that is their project. And they've succeeded in exporting it to other parts of the world, into Africa, actually. You know, there's terrible things that are going on in Uganda are basically the product of American interference, American evangelical interference in particular. You know, they've found places where they can find a political weakness and capitalize on it. And it's, you know, this is not this this anti-homosexual evangelical thing, which is also linked to the anti-abortion stuff, of course, is you know, it's not an African characteristic at all. If you look at South Africa, which has got a much more advanced political, you know, sort of setup and ethos, it's very, very different, you know. So this is the product of American of the decay of capitalism, actually, the rise of these movements, these in imperialist countries, and trying to spread this stuff around the world. It really is a very, very serious regression, and it needs to be fought, obviously.
It's also like, you know, if you look at it here now, 1917, Russia is decriminalizing homosexuality. It took till 1967 for Britain to decriminalize homosexuality. You know, we were 50 years behind the times. 50 years later, we have the LGBT community pointing the finger at Russia and saying, "Oh, you're terrible. You're not free. You're not democratic. Why? Well, because you don't allow homosexuality, and you don't allow gay marriage." And I'm going, but you don't need to get married in church in order to have a free and fair relationship. This is about saying you've got to change your religious doctrines, yes, in a society where you have to. It's not enough that you have your own laws and expected ways of behaving, but that you've got to implement them in the way we tell you to. And if next year we decide that we're going to raise the age of consent or we're going to lower it, then that's going to be how we tell you to live. And this is about the dominance instead of people's choice. Anyway, sorry.
Diana wants to speak. I'll come back after that if people don't mind.
Yeah. Russia's current social policies are regressive, but they're still not as restrictive and as bad as Britain was pre-1967. The similar to in the US, although I think possibly not quite as bad, there are regions in Russia that are banning abortion, and the Orthodox Church wants to ban abortion, but the central Russian Federation, state of the Russian Federation, is absolutely opposed to banning abortion nationally.
I'm not right in thinking, though, about
Yeah,
homosexuality.
and yeah, I was going to say a bit about homosexuality as well. Russia has introduced restrictions on homosexuality. It has not criminalized it. The law on homosexuality in Russia now is rather similar to what we had under Thatcher with Clause 28. Sorry, I'll let you come back in now. Sorry.
No, I was agreeing with you. It's not so much 67 as 79 with Thatcher and Clause 28, isn't it? You can't teach it to children, but you can, if you wish to be it, what you do behind your own closed doors is your own business.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There is a conservative element. It's a regression that's happened since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
That's what I was talking about. It's actually very similar. It's a, you know, there has been a rise of an ideological gap has been filled by parts of the church and Orthodox Christianity to a degree, but it's only to a degree. I don't think it, yeah, you know, I think it's not the, it's not in the level of virulence that you see with these evangelical Protestant sects that are going around the developing world, around the global south, and trying to, you know, basically change them and to introduce extreme, you know, sort of Christian repressive positions into parts of Africa and whatever. You know, I think it is a regression. I think we should actually say that. I think we do. I mean, it's always it's similar to the Islamic world more than the American imperial sort of you know, the American evangelical Christian thing. It's similar to the Islamic world in the sense there is a conservative element to it. Obviously, we oppose it, but we don't regard it as a something to, as a we don't we just as with the Islamic world, we do not use that as a banner to attack what Russia, which is actually under pressure for imperialism, just as the most of the Muslim world is actually. You know, I think that's a slightly different emphasis. You know, Russophobia has a very sort of similar thrust in some ways to Islamophobia. I think we have to be careful about it. We oppose it, but we don't do it, we do it in a particular way, you know. That's how I view it anyway. I mean,
I
who
think
else wants to speak? Does anybody who's not spoken want to speak?
yeah. John, Nigel, Clive, you've been very patient with us.
Actually, I wanted to ask something
Mark,
to you.
sorry.
Yeah. Two things. Wasn't it true that Lenin's sister went round schools teaching equality? And the other thing is, how many female members were there in the Bolshevik Party at the time?
I thought it was
That's
very
it.
interesting. Yeah. I'll look up the numbers for you if you like sometime. But I think it's the fact that they could certainly stand for it, stand for office and so on. But it wasn't huge numbers, but I noticed what was it? I was reading for the fourth Second International that they wanted and expected women to be, you know, fully part of all the committees, and they did. She did deliver the paper on women's equality.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. You know, I think imagining that somehow you can legislate and say, "Oh yes, we're going to be equal from now on," it doesn't happen overnight. But it was certainly true that there were more women doctors in Russia. Looked it up in the 1930s and 40s than there were, certainly in the 50s and 60s, there were more women doctors than men, but in the 30s and 40s, there were certainly a lot more than there were here.
I'll just come back on that, on the question about the Bolsheviks and women, because the Bolsheviks are very, very active on the woman question before the revolution. They had a woman section of the party. I'm not sure exactly what the relative numbers of members, female and male members were, but they actually organized women. They had their own publication called Zhenedel. You know that they actively sought to run agitation on questions involving women's rights and women's equality as a separate task of the party, a bit like a youth section actually. You know, they had a youth section as well. They deliberately made
Sorry.
these special transitional organizations to make sure these questions were addressed. You know, actually, I was in the Spartacist League. They actually tried to imitate it. They had a publication called Women and Revolution, which was actually very good at one point in the 70s. You know, it was actually based on the same idea. You know, a special communist women's magazine that was quite useful actually. The SWP did something similar with Women's Voice, but it was much more feminist. It was not really communist in quite the same way. You know, it tended to be a bit soft on various aspects of bourgeois feminism, whereas the Sparts were probably a bit abrasive, actually, which is what you, of course, that's what the Sparts are, or were. They are a bit different now, actually. But yeah, I think that idea was very, very good. Actually taking it seriously and taking the trouble to actually set up a special organ to try and carry it out. It was a sign of their commitment to agitation and propaganda and addressing the woman question as a priority. Clive wants to come in.
Just briefly, yes, the a country name came into my head during the course of the earlier discussion. It was China. It'd be interesting to compare how things developed in China to how they developed in Russia. There's certainly the same sorts of issues with not being enough working population, so that the one child a family went up to two, and just all those issues to do with what are they called? Child credits. So.
I started to research that quite a bit. I was surprised to see that in the same way that Russia had several attempts at revolutions between sort of 1900 and 1917, but China was having those sorts of communist revolutions quite well before it, and they were all stamped out by, the imperialist forces, particularly in the Manchurians, the ones that under Chiang Kai-shek, and the attempts to reimpose a Chinese imperialism on the one China pol or the one child policy. What horrified me was that basically Henry Kissinger sold that to both India and China as a means to get money from the World Bank and the IMF. They used their financial clout to persuade both China and India's ruling parties to institute the one-child policy, which of course had a totally devastating effect on the deep. And they were done not for reasons of hope helping them with industrialization or coping. They were done simply to destabilize those countries, because they knew perfectly well that if you had a one-child policy in countries which had been traditionally male rather than female oriented, yes, that there was a massive preference for a male, for a son, not a daughter, that that would destabilize those countries totally. And I'm afraid, I, as far as I can see, given how Zionist Henry Kissinger was, it was not done with the intention of trying to help those countries progress. It was done simply to destabilize them in the future. And, we're still looking at the damage. But it's interesting that China never imposed the one-child policy on ethnic minorities, yes, in the way that they are accused of, particularly with the Uyghurs. They actually, again, like Russia, supported their ethnic minorities once they had recognized that. And I don't know where the truth lies, because I don't and have never been able to travel in either. But I do listen to people talking about what there is and what there is now. And it seems to me that those countries, or certainly China, is doing its absolute best to pioneer, to nurture, yes, the ethnic skills and teachings and culture. And the awful thing about the Uyghur business is 50, 30 Arab nations went to see the Uyghurs, see all the Muslim mosques in Xinjiang, and came back and said, this is, the genocide that people keep talking about isn't happening. That this is a Western lie, which it just plays on our ignorance. Does that help at all, Clive? I would say go and look it up. Go, it was a revelation to me as to how easily we are manipulated and to believing terrible things about something, or You know, I remember all the documentaries of the dying rooms, you know, of the children left to sit in their cots or left in their, you know, high chairs and things. But we don't see, you know, we don't see as much about America being the euthanasia capital of the world that Hitler based his final solution on. Yeah.
Mark wants to speak.
I was just going to say, China, I've completely forgotten the thread now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Oh, yeah, I know. I've been visiting China on a couple of occasions.
Oh,
I was pretty impressed with the fact that they're very culturally diverse and that they're very religiously diverse as well. In fact, I went to church on Easter Sunday with a Christian that we stayed with at university. That was quite impressive. That was a new experience, although I'm not at all religious. But I kind of think, well, if China's that bad with Muslims, why are the Muslim countries turning to them for help? The other point I'd like to make is one week it would be nice to talk about the other communist countries like Bulgaria, countries like that. We don't really ever talk about it. It'd be nice to kind of compare them all and find out what really happened there.
Can I just
so that's all I've got.
Can I just comment on that? I mean, I think that my understanding is that the difference between China and Russia on this is so like in so many things, it's the nature of the revolution, really. I mean, the things that we're talking about under Stalinism in the 30s didn't really have their opposite in China when the revolution happened, because you know, the Russian Revolution was a proletarian revolution. The Chinese Revolution was a bit more ambiguous. It was a peasant war, really, that brought to power a bureaucratic, an already bureaucratized Stalinist faction based on the peasantry. And it was probably fairly conservative. It had the same sort of conservative views that Trotsky is criticizing on among the Stalin regime on these things. Having said that, however, there was a big... There's an element of feudal oppression of women in China, or pre-capitalist oppression. Probably best not to call it feudal, but there's a pre-capitalist element of oppression of women. Things like foot binding and things like this, you know, which actually the Chinese Revolution interacted with the revolution of Sun Yat-sen, etc., which was against that sort of oppressive imperial pre-capitalist. Society. So it sort of combined with that, actually. But the problem is that by 1949, the communists based on the working class in China were smashed in the late 20s, weren't they? You know, and they went to they left the cities and adopted a strategy of rural guerrilla warfare. And that, I think that was a different type of revolution. It created a state that's pretty much like Stalin's Russia was in the 30s, really, right from the very beginning. So I think that's a complex. I agree. We should actually talk about. Mark is right. We should talk about other worker states. So that it's actually a very big subject. I think we should finish this book first and think about something else to study. You know, because there is stuff. There's a lot of material on these things. You know, worth studying.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing that's people have right. I've been talking to Paul about studying the Burnham-Shackman fight in the American SWP, which is about the nature of the Soviet Union. It has a big impact on the left today because it's the precursor of what's called third campism, the politics of the SWP, and to a certain extent the politics of the AWL as well. Well, the SWP is obviously much bigger and more important to us because it's a large organisation, you know, whereas the AWL is quite a small one. But they are significant, and those discussions are there's stuff for the future that we can discuss anyway as possible future educationals. But Susan wants to speak. I won't hog the... Yeah.
No. I was just going to say very quickly, I wonder to what extent it's also the fact that Mao Zedong, if you like, led communist China from the 1930s until the 1960s. It's a very long time compared with Stalin, you know, dying in 53. But the other thing is that I think it would also be good to study Cuba and Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, and the extent to which communism can survive under the thumb of, if you like, American imperialism, and, you know, what we can learn from their fight against oppression as to how much that has affected the oppression that was inflicted on Russia and China and their development. Because we're not looking at communism or socialism or anything else under the light of, you know, being allowed to grow on their own and flower and not be harmed and damaged. We're looking at people who are constantly being battered and undermined and hurt by, you know, British, American imperialism, European imperialism, and two world wars, and the total oppression of, you know, fascist regimes that have constantly invaded them, and the financial institutions that have undermined them. Anyway, so, yeah, I think we'd learn a lot from all of them.
Mark?
I was going to say, one of the impressions I got from China as well was that it's steeped in old traditions. Everybody seemed to be doing what they liked. There was a lot of Confucianism, and there was a lot of stuff going on that was old, a lot of stuff that was going on that was new. So it was pretty well mixed up. And the bits, some bits I've read about Mao and some bits I've read in his writing, he sounded quite tolerant in some cases. He talked about, in one case, he talked about not judging landlords as being all the same. Some of them were quite helpful and useful to the peasants, and some of them weren't. So, not to pass judgment so quickly. The other thing is a complete change of subject. There was a big left-wing party in America, wasn't there, started by the actor Will Geer, the father in the Waltons. And apparently people like Sinatra were putting money into it, and it became quite a big organisation. I don't know much about it, but that would be interesting to look into. If there's any information on that.
Yeah. And the Black Panther movement, of course, and Malcolm X, as well as...
Yeah, that's right.
Clive.
Yep.
Yeah, so I thought I'd say it quickly before anyone else did. I kept waiting for someone to say it. And, of course, Cuba.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and the rest. But, yeah. Nigel and Paul?
Anybody else want to speak? I think this discussion is coming to its end, I think.
We've had some fun for...
Yeah, it's been a very good discussion, actually. You know, a very, very good presentation. Does anybody want to sum up or do any summary or anything like that for Marie or Susan or Diana?
I can repeat my little bit that I gave you, if you like. The women's problem is men, and it won't be solved until we solve the problem of the way men and women interact in the home, their social lives, as well as the workplace and public life. And that's what we really, and that I suspect starts with education and equality in, you know, what I feel like you call social justice.
Marie.
Just a few more words, and I agree with what Susan said, and Diana. I think that perhaps so, though it is important to go and look at the other revolutions, we have now the opportunity to look at this one, and it is a key one. The Russian Revolution is key because it's the one that went the deepest in the proletarian direction. The working class is the last class in history There is not another one after that. And this is why, as there was a regression and a Thermidor, it did not constitute a new class. And I think if you look well in all this document, never Trotsky speaks of the ruling class. He says the ruling strata or the upper strata and the lower layers of society. But he doesn't say that it's a class which has developed against the working class. And the importance of that is that before we go to look at other revolutions, this one is showing to us that history has reached the end of the line, that the next class, when it takes power, the working class, it removes the classes, because there's no more classes. And this is why the bureaucracy cannot be a class. And I think this is an important aspect to keep looking at as we go to chapter 8 and the other chapters, so that though we should look at Cuba and the rest of it, the key to this historical conclusion is here in Trotsky, and that nobody else has analyzed it anywhere else. Yeah.
Sure.
Can I ask a question, Marie? Would that make us the most regressive society because we still have a monarchy and a class system which is entirely based on, you know, snobbery and class? Yes.
Well, and answer that very quickly, and then you can
I was going to say,
thank you, Paul. I noticed that the Workers' Party of Britain has no to NATO and for the elimination of the monarchy in its program.
Okay. Finally, I have a reason to think about voting for it.
So I think there is a very big possibilities here. I'm disappointed that the United Front, which is forming, has accepted the 2019 program, the one of Corbyn, the 20, you know, whereas there is the program of the Workers' Party is much better. And
apologies, Paul, for jumping in. And
yeah, Paul's
come on.
For having jumped in.
Well, I disagree with some aspects what Maori just said immediately towards the end. I mean, some of us are actually from a Corbynist style background, but actually the Workers' Party have got a lot to be desired when it comes to the environment. So that was and at least the other, Murray calls it the United Front, do tend to be a much better on the environment, whereas the Workers' Party, if you actually read their manifesto, there's an element of climate change denial going on there for the sake of defending jobs, and that's the wrong way to approach environmental situations. This is a kind of halfway house for those that may wish to look at other countries. I still think we should finish the book because the whole point of the whole point of reading it as a group is to because it's a lot to read on your own, and it's very difficult to understand what it really means if you're only reading it on your own. So that's why I like reading groups, those that I've been on. I do find them helpful. But as a kind of sort of halfway house, maybe, obviously we meet every 2 weeks, maybe once in a while we could use 1 week to talk about one of the other countries, and then the following fortnight we then go back to setting that gets a suggestion. But yes, I do think we should continue with the book. But some people might wish to maybe have a break and then go on to China or Cuba every now and then. So do you understand my suggestion? Maybe have rather than go on to the next chapter, in the next fortnight to go on to maybe have a general discussion about Colonel Gruber, and then we go back to the chapter again on the cookies. So that's kind of like a halfway house, if you will, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Can I just make one point? I mean, I think we should continue with this chapter at least, because we're only a third of the way through it, actually. And we got two more. I think we probably should draw this discussion to a close now, because it's getting on a bit. It's 5:45. But I was just thinking, I mean, what do we want to do about the next part of this chapter, which is on youth and the situation with the youth in Russia in the 30s and the degeneration of the revolution? What should we do about that? I mean, should I do a presentation in 2 weeks' time? If you like, I mean, we can parcel this out and do it and get other people to do. If anybody wants to volunteer to do something, they're very welcome, you know. But failing that, I'll do one in 2 weeks' time. Yeah, if that's all right. On the second part of this chapter, I mean, if you're going to take a break from the book, we could actually, you know, have a special one-off session when we get to the end of a chapter and perhaps go and do something else for a little while and then come back to the next chapter. I think that seems more logical, doesn't it? You know, than breaking in the middle of a chapter. Yeah, these things are interesting. We could probably have a general discussion on the other deformed worker states, you know, perhaps. When we finish this chapter and come back to it. But on the other hand, the other problem is, of course, is that some of the material in the later part of the book is very relevant for understanding those countries as well. So I don't know, we'll have to think about it, yeah? Okay, shall we do that in 2 weeks' time then? I'll do another presentation on the second part of this chapter, if you like. We could... If we agree to stop this, so two more comrades want to speak, but after that we can stop the recording and perhaps go on to any other business, if that's all right with people, yeah? But Diana wants to speak first anyway.
Yeah, I'm happy with suggestions about continuing the book with the book and presentations. I just have a question to ask about Trotsky. What, if any, was his position on environmental issues? Lenin actively supported Russian ecologists and environmentalists. Stalin was a bit harsher on them. I don't think he stopped them altogether, but he did end up sticking one in prison who died there. So I'd just like to know what Trotsky's position was, or if he had one.
Marie?
Oh, yeah, that's just a question. I see that Nigel has put a little note who he suggests Albania.
In Mahoja, yeah.
I wonder perhaps he knows about this and would make a presentation at some stage.
Mm-hmm. I'd certainly like to learn more.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
I can do, but I'm not. My politics is slightly different to this group, so I'm not sure if that would be okay.
Oh, I think it's an excellent idea. we are more different than perhaps we sound when we're all reading off the same page.
Okay, I could do it in about a month's time or something if you want.
Yeah, that would be a possibility. Yeah,
great. I'll tell you what. To answer the Diane bit, I think we are encouraged by the West to think climate change is a new thing, whereas people like Jack London and, you know, environmentalists in the 1910s were complaining about environmental degradation and climate change then. And I can't believe that Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin weren't perfectly aware. It was whether or not they prioritized it. What I was angry about was the extent to which Lysenko sold them nurture rather than nature, but that's been something that's that's part and parcel of the, shall we say, the fight between reality versus wishful thinking that infects, you know, a great many societies and leaders when they don't want to face reality, doesn't it? You know, Stalin was sold the idea that somehow you just had to work harder and you would create, you know, you would present more crops. Lied about the production. Yes, but everything can't be in the genes, because although we are all born with the genes we've got, it's quite clear that the environment affects them and and how we are nurtured throughout our lives.
So Ian wants to speak?
Just very briefly, I have an idea there's something about environmental questions in problems of everyday life, but I can't quite place it at the moment. There may well be, I'll have to go and check, actually. But I think Lenin's views and Trotsky's views are very, very, very similar. I mean, the real problem in Russia, of course, in the Soviet Union, there was considerable environmental degradation caused by an over-industrialization, you know, over-focus on heavy industry. And there was a lot of pollution in the Stalinist period, which I think was unnecessary, because it was actually an overemphasis on autarky and development within one country, as opposed to seeking to broaden the revolution out to the rest of the world. And I think that is something that really is implicit in what Trotsky is writing. It may well be, I can't remember, but I'm sure there's something somewhere I've seen. It may be problems of in everyday life. I'm not sure. I have to go and check that. But anyway. Mm-hmm. Can I stop the recording? Is that okay?
Please.
We can go on to the business. Yeah.